This is Doreen Howard. It's December 6, 2005. We're at UAW Local 602. Today we will be interviewing Sally Jo Grubaugh. I'd like everyone to go around the room and introduce themselves.
Doug Rademacher.
Cheryl McQuaid.
John Fiedewa.
Okay. Sally, can you please state your name and spell your last name, please?
Okay. My name is Sally Grubaugh. G-R-U-B-A-U-G-H.
Okay. What's your seniority date, Sally?
6/18 of 78 was the final date they came up with.
Okay. Do you remember your very first day of coming to the plant? And can you recall the circumstances around that day?
It's like it was yesterday. Walking in the plant for the first time and smelling all the smells and hearing all the noises and all the different squeals and motors running and getting, it was such a combination of smoke and people. I mean, it was like plastic smells, rubber smells, and I remember shaking in my boots because I'd never been in a factory environment. So the circumstances that actually led up to me coming there was I had been working for private doctors, and I had just gone through a divorce and had three young children that I needed to support along with myself. So, in fact, my mother was up here, and I was at work, and she said, Fisher Body is hiring, but you need to get down there. So I took my lunch half hour in my office whites and came into the Verlinden entrance down the steps, and nobody else, of course, was in white like I was, white shoes, white slacks, white top. Obviously, you know, I came from a different environment. And Jerry Brooks was at the table, and I filled out the form, and he said, you know, this isn't quite like the work you've been doing. And I said, yeah, I realize that, but I've got three children to raise now, so I can do anything. So about less than a week, they called me out to come to work. But like I said, when I walked in, factory work was nothing I'd ever imagined, you know, after being an X-ray, that I'd be doing. But I wasn't making enough money. The insurance was going to start coming out of my paycheck, and I was making 5 1/4 an hour. So I was awake nights trying to figure out a budget, you know, what I could not do and do, or I was going to be forced into working two jobs in order to support my family and keep the home I was in. So basically, I came to Fisher Body for the wages, the pension that I probably would have never had working for private doctors, and the insurance. So, and I was willing to work and do anything. So
that first day, you said you came in and all the sights and sounds and smells that you were unfamiliar with. What department did they put you in? And describe a little bit of the job that they put you on.
Oh, that's a good one. Well, the first day, it was in the trim department. It was on the day shift. The first day, they put me doing like a pickup job with another individual. In fact, he's deceased. I remember who it was. And I worked that day on this job, and it was just bits and pieces. It wasn't anything that you'd probably label a job now, but, you know, it was my first day there. And the one thing I remember for that first month, I didn't vary going in and out of the plant. If you think, the size of the plant is like how many blocks long, and I thought, if I ever get lost, I will never find my way out. So I kept the same pattern in and out and didn't vary one lick. But the next day, to go on with the story, they put me on trunk rubbers. And back in those days, trunk rubbers were like tire rubbers. They had a metal cord that went through them. And the fellow that broke me in must have been fighting the job, because for one thing, I was a female, and I don't think he was real thrilled about, you know, breaking in a female on this job. And he showed me the absolute worst way of doing it. That's all I got to say. This was like, I went on the job Tuesday, and we were working Saturdays. Back in those days, it was a lot of overtime, and you were working 6 days a week. And you had to, basically, he told me to beat this rubber on with my hand and go all the way around the circumference. It was every other job. And then you had to cut it to fit through a metal wire, and they gave you these non-ergonomic, great big shears that you had to use two hands on to get through that metal. And then you bunted it up together. Plus, you had to put sealer on prior to that. Well, by the time Saturday came up, every muscle and part of my body was screaming, but I knew better than to go to medical. I mean, I slept with my arms crossed on my chest. And by, 2 o'clock or whatever it was, I mean, every part of my body, I couldn't hardly get my thumb to even move, you know, on the sealer gun. Well, then the folks around me started coming up there and helping me and showing me an easier way of doing it. But they let me get through those first 2 or 3 days struggling like crazy. And then they came to my rescue when they could see that I was really getting frustrating and hurting. Then they came around to show me the better way of doing things and not to do it the way that I was instructed. So I stayed on this job until, of course, this was like the middle of October. You know, the whole thing was to get your 90 days in, but what I didn't know at the time was they hired a lot of people and then they laid them off, gave them a pink slip before they could get that 90 days in. So the day before Thanksgiving, when I thought I had everything, I mean, everything was going smooth and I had that job right down pat, is when I got my slip to go out the door again, which was a big surprise to me. But prior to that, my supervisor had asked me to put in a slip for supervision because he thought I got along with people and I'd make a good supervisor. So I hung out there for several months, drawing unemployment and hating it. The first time in my life I ever had to go in, stand in line, and go to the unemployment desk, and people kind of treated you like you were somebody that had been on unemployment all your life, which I hadn't. But then I got a call to come in for an interview for supervision. This was in January. And I've been calling back to the plant to see, you know, when I was going to come back to work, because I was really getting edgy. But I went through this in January, and I got called up in February and told I was selected to go through supervision training. So in March I started that, and fortunately that gave me some time onto my plant time that I wasn't getting being laid off because I hadn't gotten called back. So I went through 3 months of training, and that's how I wound up with June of 78 seniority. At the end of the supervision training, I was asked, well, they were telling me they would put me on per diem, but they already had pre-selected the people they wanted to go on. I'll just put it that way. So I saw no security in that night, and they wanted me to go on. I said, no, I don't want to go on per diem. And it was Frank Mai. He was quite a person. And I said, no, I want to go back the line. So I had to sign a statement that I didn't want supervision, that I wanted to go back to the line. So that's what I did come July. After changeover, I wasn't clued in enough to know that you could work changeover and gain some time. So I went back to the line, and I felt a lot more secure that I had a union, that I had somebody to back me up, and I wasn't going to be used back and forth. The other thing that I think I realized through the training was I was a people person. and I could see that there weren't that many females in supervision back in those days, and I just didn't see any future of me getting any farther than a first-line supervisor because I would fight for the people on the floor. And I don't think I would have gotten very far, but maybe years of doing that. So I went back to work on the line. And I worked on the line for a little over 9 years before I got the ergonomics position. So, and that was wonderful.
And you said you started in ergonomics in what year?
1987, one of the first two people. Actually, Ron Grubaugh, who I'm not related to, was working in, I mean, he and I were the first two people put on ergonomics. And we basically were flying by the seat of our pants for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, before they actually put into effect a kind of dictated or, you know, program that came from. But I think we got a lot accomplished in those 3 years. We made a lot of major improvements. One example was, and there may be people that disagree with me, but at the time, they had Makitas all over. They had Makita motors. And we were driving self-tapping screws with Makitas. Now, the good thing about Makitas was you could move with them and not be, you know, limited to a whatever foot long, and I can't even remember, 8 foot, 10 foot, whatever the dimensions were at that time. They had long hoses on the floor. I mean, all over the place.
Now, what,
you know,
what is a Makita? Can you
Makita is a battery-powered tool. I remember they were green. I mean, they were all over the place. People liked them because they could move with them and not be limited by that hose. But the problem was, you know, they weren't powerful enough to drive some of the things that they were doing. And we replaced them with some good air tools unless they were people that really needed that mobility, like repair people and stuff. But we could see that the figures were going down significantly from just that change and getting some good air motors. And we went all the way through trim, getting different motors and devising some plans, starting to work on other things. But that was probably the first major thing we did. In the body shop, one of the biggest problems down there was silicon bronze and all the back picking and stuff, and that was a major injury area. And there wasn't a whole lot. Basically, what they did was they threw people at it, and throwing people at it and not being able to fix it, we had tons of injuries. But that's the way that they did things in those days. So the posture was awkward. They actually had to reach inside the car with a back pick and a hammer to get the seam that was on the inside of the sail area, which would be the back upper quarter, and back pick and even out that seam. So there were lots and lots of injuries. And once that went away, we thought, well, good. We're never going to have this problem again. But in the wisdom of upper engineering, we got that problem back, but it wasn't back picking, but it was grinding off the silicon bronze seam, and that was just in recent years. And guess what? We had more injuries. So sometimes there's wisdom in history that people don't seem to grasp, or maybe the engineers that came up with this plan were not aware of all the history and injuries. Now, the people in this plant, maybe not management, but were well aware of what happened during those early days. But, sometimes things like that get overlooked. So, and even modern technology didn't take all of it away. So robotic sprayers and controls and stuff that were supposed to, you know, check that so we wouldn't have as much grinding to do. Well, it didn't always work out as planned. The people still were the people that still had to clean up those scenes and fill them in and make them so we had a quality car going out the door.
So, over your time frame of being in the ergonomics department, how did that department change over time? You said you started out with two people in that department, and it's quite a large department at this time, is it not?
No. Well, we started with two, and then we put on a third person later. And then at one time, we had to go out there and analyze every single job in the plant. So we put on some ergonomic monitors as well, because we had to do checklists on every job in the plant. And at the time, this was in the early 90s. So that was an awesome job and an awesome task, you know, to go out and see where we were at ergonomically by checklists. I think those checklists a lot of times failed in some respects to show really what was happening out there. Even the current checklist fails that. But at the time I think we had three ergonomics representatives, and when we had three monitors to get that job done. And then after that job was completed, then the monitors went away and we went back to three people. And we've had people and lost people, or people got, you know, went out of there and came into there. So at the very end of the car assembly run, I was the only person left there for a number of months. One person came on for a few months but went over to Delta. But basically the last year or so, I was the one trying to cover most of, along with the salary ergonomics person, to cover the plant. So it was kind of a depressing but awesome task.
Doug
Rademacher. Sally, I've worked in there 27 years with you. Of course, appreciate all you have done. I was just curious, could you talk about, you said you hired in on the assembly line. You got a chance to come back and learn about how they do frontline supervision.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got this opportunity to go into this ergonomics field.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no guidelines at the start, but I had a number of jobs, and I know it had to be very stressful. I know that you were trying to help people, but can you talk about the type of, when you would walk up to a job where someone has said that this job is hurting them? I know many times you were faced with people that were angry and stuff. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, I worked on that line. So believe me, I believed in those people out on that line, and I had a high respect that, you know, I was a resource. And I can only remember one time that I actually told an individual that, you know, I would come back once he settled down, because he was absolutely just, you know, just not able to talk to him. And I explained to him I was there as a resource to help him, but I realized that he must have a problem, but, you know. But that was the only individual that I really had to walk away from. I think what people need is that respect to sit them down and find out what's actually going on and what the problem is. Sometimes it was an ergonomics issue. Sometimes it was not. It was a job loading issue or whatever. But, you know, people deserve that time and that investment to go out and hear them out and see what you could do to fix the problem. So, you know, there's a lot of times it was you were the first person that finally was there that they can vent or listen to them. And by the time possibly you got there, They had gone through other resources and were completely frustrated. You know, whether it was a supervisor, whether it was engineering. You know, and of all the issues I think that I heard the most of were parts that were in spec, meaning, you know, that there's a certain area where the vendors are allowed to run these parts. Now, if you get parts at one end, you can probably put them on very easily. But if they're on the other end of those guidelines, you're literally squeezing, hammering, and pushing them on. Well, many times they were told those parts were in spec. You know, so, but they were on the one extreme side. And if there's anything I think that anybody could do, I mean, there were times I couldn't do anything because that was what you would run into it. And you'd go in there and ask engineering, can you close up those specs? Can you get it down to this end? Can you keep them within these limits? Well, no. They try to, but that doesn't mean that's what's coming in that day. You know, and they try to go out and find good parts and put them on the line. But in the meantime, after a day or two of getting these bad quality parts, you've got three, four, half a dozen people down to medical because they can't do it that way and do it without hurting themselves.
You know, Sally, you said that you recognized, as did management, recognized problems in the build process, and they just kept throwing bodies at it, and you'd get injuries, and then they'd throw more bodies at it rather than... You just said how difficult it was to get a change in a part or something. So, can you give someone that's never been in an assembly plant or built a car, you were talking about the frustration, but is there like a timeline when you recognized a problem and the amount of work that went into changing it? Is there was something called a 6-month letter. I just was wondering. You know, I went through that myself, so I was wondering if you could maybe share about that. So when a person is at the end of their wits and they're struggling to do a job, and yet you're given this, what they call is this...
6-month timeline, yes. Actually, that was to give people or engineering the opportunity to put some changes in with a 6-month limit, you know, to allow them time. That doesn't mean we didn't have more injuries, but that was the way it was set up with the ergonomics program. Later on, and more recently, there was still kind of a 6-month time frame, but platform, which I mean engineering above the plant level, once we opened a job that we said that we had an ergonomics problem and we stated that problem, whether it was engineering or not, they kept track of, you know, if we had a solution to the problem, how long that time frame was to get that solution done. You know, so they stayed on top of the managers in the plan to then rectify or resolve this problem and know where this was going. Before that, it was like a turkey shoot. You know, I mean... Some people just didn't take ergonomics that seriously. And there were many times I came back to that office and just wanted to tear things apart or tear managers apart. They tell you one thing and then not act on it, or tell their upper, say, plant manager something totally different than what was actually happening. And they allowed us one meeting a month in a staff meeting that you felt like very not welcome. They wanted to get you in and out of there to let them know what was going on with ergonomics. And you didn't often get a warm, fuzzy feeling. You know, you tried to present to them, but they didn't want to hear too many details. They wanted you in there and out of there. And about the only time you got into details was if the union asked you questions about what was going on, or you volunteered some information, you know. But that's where the 6-month time frame, and that was frustrating for a lot of people because it was like, you know, you try to look for other avenues of getting it done besides a 6-month time frame a lot of times. And there was a lot of times I didn't take no as an answer. If somebody told me no, then I was going to find somebody else that would help work with me and try to get, whether it was a supervisor, whether it was an engineer. I didn't care who it was. If they could do it and help me, you know, get it fixed in a faster time frame, then I was willing to run with it. But there was a lot of times that that didn't happen half as fast or even, you know, as what I would have liked happen.
Was there ever a time where you approached skilled trades and took a task on yourself rather than following the procedure?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, when, yes, go grab somebody and say, hey, you know, there were tools and stuff that I had made that, you know, to help put in parts that weren't going in easy. And I think another frustration I had was when we made these small tools and things, they never kept any record that we'd made these tools and had another one standing by so they could make more as we needed them. I put in a suggestion to the effect that they keep track and have a print or something in there so when we went back there, I wouldn't have to, well, I got smart and started keeping a few in my desk because, you know, the people would hand them out and they'd be gone, they'd move on, but they'd keep the tools with them, you know. But then you go back to tooling, well, gee, can you bring me another one? Because I don't know what we made because so-and-so made it. And I'm going like, well, why didn't we keep a print or something so we knew what we had made so we're not back out there, you know, reinventing the wheel, so to speak. So I put in a suggestion that was turned down. It cost too much money to do that, even though the other plant on the other side had done it all the time. In fact, toolmakers had told me. But, you know, so much for life. So I just managed to try to keep at least one of those tools on my desk so I could, you know, or a half dozen so I'd have more ahead so I could have them to hand out.
So. Sally, Doreen had referred to it earlier about the changes you've seen. As far as ergonomics, the corporation and the union, they say that their job, one, is to get you home safely. They want you to go home the way you came in. Did you see a time in history where that actually took place? I know we have our monthly safety review on how not to burn down your home or how not to trip over something, but did you feel there was a time when there was a true effort put into caring about the worker on the line?
Oh, goodness. I wanted to believe there were people that really, truly cared about that worker on that line because I was representing them. You know, there were many times where I felt just the opposite. In fact, there were many times I even got laughed at when I got upset by one individual and was laughing at me. And if there was ever a time I wanted to meet somebody out in the parking lot and put my, you know, boxing, well, there was more than one, but that, this has been more recently, you know, after we went through the effort of finally getting something in place after years, and then he shipped this equipment to the other side, and our people, they weren't even going to put it up. They were going to ship it to the other side, you know, on the other system. And I called him up and I asked him, is this true? And, oh, yeah. Yep, we're moving it over there now. And I said, well, you know, we need the other. We built this equipment for the other system as well. And, well, you know, we're not going to spend the money to put it up and then take it down in a month or two. So, that was about the time I wrote a letter to the plant manager and said, you know what, people don't deserve to be treated like this. The only problem that came back to bite me by the time they got it hung up there, the people were so mad about losing their jobs that they didn't want to use the equipment now. So, you know, sometimes you feel like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, but, you know, the effort was there. And like I said, there were several times that I knew there was no getting to some individuals because it was like, beam me up, Scotty. There's no sign of intelligent life here. So I couldn't beat any sense into them. But I still had a job to do for those people on the floor. And you don't know how many times I just went back there so frustrated I was in tears and I was angry. And I, you know, I didn't know what to do or what resource I had. You know, and, you know, sometimes I felt I was the only one in this boat, you know, because I had to do the job, you know, and I got it done the best I could with the resources I had. That's all I can say. But no, I don't think that that statement about the safety is always pertaining to the ergonomics portion of repetitive workload and recovery time issues that nobody even wants to hear about anymore. But I do believe if they keep cutting jobs out, and that's the only significant way of cutting costs, then we're in big trouble because they're going to hurt more people in the process and burn them out sooner. Unless they can guarantee good parts and good things for those times that they're saying that people can get that job done. Because people cannot get that job done if they're struggling on that assembly line to get to do the job that they would do in a heartbeat 150% if they had the right resources and right equipment. And that, I believe, as much as, you know, all the years I worked doing it, I believe that.
Well, this is a good story and where you're going, and I understand that you're talking, you're going to retire now. But I want to go into some thoughts and make you go to a place and a happy time. Can you talk about some good times you had? Times with the people, friends you've made, things that happened on maybe a weekly basis that were kind of fun?
Actually, the most fun I had was when I worked on the assembly line. And the camaraderie. I miss that, you know, and the job I did. We had all kinds of, I mean, there was all kinds of people out there. I remember one in particular, and the people that they brought in on tours, and God love them. I think, you know, I don't think they sometimes really realize that we were people just like them working on the line. They didn't know what, but there were some people that tried to make it out like we were animals. And there was one in particular. As soon as that tour bus would go by, he'd reach over, this was a guy, and he would kiss another guy. So this poor tour bus would see this. And you could see the expression on those people's face. And we're going, oh, no. You know. But it was just, this one particular individual was just a crack up. And because we never know what to expect out of him. But usually it was something you could laugh at. And just go, those people really must think we're animals in here now, you know, with them doing that. But, oh, shoot. There were, I'm trying to think back those first 9 or so years. I look forward to coming into the plant. I look forward to being around the people. I did on ergonomics, too. I mean, I think I enjoyed going, for the most part, talking to the people and communicating to the people out there. That was what made me go. It still does. That's why I'm going to have to find myself a part-time job out there doing something somewhere and being appreciated somewhere. So I'm going to do that. But talking to the people, interacting with the people, And doing what I could do for the people all those years was what kept me going. When I was on empty, you know, there was always those individuals when you're running on empty that would, you know, that would give you a hug, or when you're ready to throw in the towel, and God knows I was. I don't know how many times, but, you know, there was that somebody said something that revived all that your frustration, and you said, you know what? I'm going out there, and I'm not taking no for an answer, and I'm going to hit it again, you know. But there were fun times, but those, I think most of the fun times were those first 9 years when I was out there and kidding around, and oh, somebody'd have music on, and they'd be, you know, dancing around, you know, when the line go down, or which wasn't that often after so many years, but you know, there was a lot of good times, and there's a lot of really super good people out there. So you know, that's why I still continue to believe in the people out there from all facets of life, from all ethnic backgrounds. I mean, it's I met all kinds of people, and that was great.
I want to ask you, before I know the ladies want to get into this interview a little bit, but I want you to talk about the union, and what's the union's, what did you see in the union? You saw many different union reps. the style of representation has changed. What do you think about the union and its efforts to help the worker?
I think, there again, you're dealing with different individuals, you know, and I guess I say, to be honest, I think some people have their own agendas, you know, politically to be reelected, and some people were out there doing what they needed to do. So has the style changed? Has the politics gone away? No, it never will. I think there were some really good people in there that did the job, you know, and did were out there for the benefit of those people on the floor and would do anything for them. And there were some people that I think were cruising, you know, that they did what they had to do, but I don't think sometimes their motives or they had other agendas, but that's just my own personal. But, I mean, I worked with, I don't know how many union people. I think I'll have to say, for the most part, people started in, you know, wanting to do what they could, but because of some limitations to what they can do and how you work with and the limitations of the managers you're working with. Because if the manager doesn't believe in this or that, or the people on that floor being other than robots, you know, you're not going to get anywhere with that particular manager unless you go over their head and explain what's not happening there. But I think a lot of the time we didn't have the opportunity to get back to the union or for the union to check in and say, well, sit down, have a cup of coffee with you and find out what's really going on. In more recent times, you didn't have that opportunity. You just did your job, don't ask questions, and just produce whatever you're asked to produce. So, you know, sometimes I think there were some gains, and sometimes I think we went backwards. So, that's only my personal opinion. But I believe if things had happened differently, that I'd be over at Delta right now instead of retiring. But I got burned out, and nobody asked me why or how the job was going. You know, I had to rely on salaried folks to get some things done where I couldn't rely on the union folks. So, you know. And nobody really ever came to me and asked me after 18 years of experience if that was anything they could use over there. So, That's the truth.
Doreen Howard. Fisher Body has always been called the capital of quality. How do you feel about that statement and from the ergonomics aspect of it?
Fisher Body is always, you know, the sad thing is that plant's going down. It's going to be destroyed. I can't take my kids over there. Well, my kids have been there, but my grandkids or even future grandchildren over there and say, this is where your grandmother worked. And before that, her father worked before World War II, which I didn't find out until I came to work here. But as far as the capital of quality, I believe in the people of Lansing, the workforce that has been disrupted and split up and sent all over the, you know, due to the circumstances and the changing times, Oldsmobile going away, although we're fortunate to have two new plants. But that quality is with those people on that assembly line. It's not, the people should be supporting them, the managers, you know, and supporting them with products, quality parts and things so that they can produce, you know, these quality products. And there are some limitations to just how much you can get out of these people without literally breaking them. So I hope at some point in time, that somebody gets smart and decides that maybe, you know, maybe loading jobs and reducing jobs isn't the only where things can be cut or you know, you're going to have to look at other areas.
Cheryl McQuaid. Sally, you mentioned that you did trunk rubbers. Do you remember some of the other jobs you did? And did you ever do any jobs that were ergonomically incorrect?
Oh, my goodness. I've got a thumb here that back in the cushion room, that hog ringing, there were plenty of jobs that would not have been considered correct. So that I did. Regulators, you know, we worked very hard to get that door line set up, get doors off, proving that we had an injury history because of trying to be in those doors and accommodate those arms going in those small holes that, you know, there were a lot of awkward, hard posture. So we got the door line set up to alleviate some of that, you know, and get a better height situation. And then, lo and behold, somebody comes up with the idea of putting the doors back on the car and putting the rear door of all of them back on the car where you've got the least amount of room. So, you know, there were things, and I guess that was another one of the frustrating. You get things done. You know, there's such a thing as lessons learned. Well, apparently, whoever comes up with some of these bright ideas never had any lessons learned. They thought it was going to be a cost savings. Even though we presented to staff, I wasn't a part of that. The presentation was made, the numbers were pulled up to show how much we had saved in injuries with having that door line, and they still went ahead and put that door back on the car because they were determined there was a cost savings there. And I think they proved out that cost savings was not what they had.
Sally, could you tell us a little bit more about the first... I'm sorry, Cheryl McQuaid. Sally, would you tell us a little bit more about the first 9 years? You talked about trunk rubbers and being in the cushion room hog ringing. Could you tell us a little bit about maybe your first supervisor or your favorite supervisor and why he was a favorite supervisor?
Okay. Well, I did have some favorite supervisors, and the one that I remember probably the most was Bob. I'm trying to think of his last name. His son works up in paint. Blummer. Blummer. In fact, I was laid off for a time, and Bob made sure that he got me in his area. And this was a time when we were in trim, and we had this great big Bertha press up there that was broken down more than it ever worked. And Bob was a character. We were out there hand beating out, cutting out holes with like a maul and a cutting. Finally, the skilled trades come up with these tools that we had to literally beat holes out because this press wasn't working a good majority of the time. And I mean, we were working our butts off to try to keep the line going. But Bob was the kind of person you do anything for him, you know. And he'd come over there and, you know, we'd be joking around and we were doing our job. But, you know, he would come over and tell jokes and, you know, keep us stimulated, and we'd tell him. And he, you know, he was the kind of person that knew his people. He would bring you a cup of coffee and sit down with you and ask you how things were going at home and didn't treat you like you were just a robot that was there to do a certain job and certain things. You know, he wanted to know what was going on with the real you and what was going on with the family and what, you know, kind of activities that the kids were in. And you know, he was just a warm and funny and great guy to work for because he looked out for you, you know. And as far as a bad supervisor, I guess those were the supervisors that treated you like you were not a human being, that didn't care, you know, for, you know, everybody has a bad day and everybody comes in there. They could have been up all night with their kids. I don't know how many times I went to work when I only had 2 or 3 hours of sleep because my kids were sick and it was only me. I was a single parent, you know, and I'd take that half hour of what we were supposed to have lunch break and sleep so I could get through the next 3 hours. But there were just some individuals that were flat out from the book, didn't care, you know, and, you know, they wouldn't listen to you when you had a problem. And I don't mean a personal problem. I mean a problem that you were having with parts or whatever was happening at the time. They wouldn't react to it. You know, you were putting them to a little more work or effort than they wanted to do. And I guess that would be the kind of supervisor that I didn't want, because I think anybody in there would work 150% if they had the supervisor that was really taking the time to make sure they were getting good parts or, you know, was in tune with that individual, so to speak, and knew what they could, you know, how you treat people. If you treat people with respect, in almost 99% of the time, you're going to get the respect back. So,
do you remember a partner that sticks out in your mind, that maybe they did something that you just can't believe that they were that thoughtful or what made a good partner?
Oh, I had a lot of good partners over those 9 years. I really did. I had a lot more than I had bad partners, so that was fortunate for me. I guess one of the one that I can't forget, Nancy Phelan, back in the cushion room. And oh, here's a humorous thing I just thought of, too. One night, I came in with glasses on, and what I didn't realize, they were my son's glasses. Remember the old dark black, all the shop glasses looked the same, you know. They were these big, thick plastic frames, and then the lens. Well, I had accidentally picked up my son's glasses, and my job was to read off a number to get it on the line for the cushion. So that was important, that I was getting the right frame out there for these cushions. Well, I was having a heck of a time seeing. And I didn't realize it. The supervisor, and it was Carla Gates, way back when, come up there and she said, "Sally, you're getting these numbers wrong." And I'm going like, "I don't know what's going on." Well, it was these, I didn't wear prescription glasses at the time, and these were prescription, and I'm going like, "Darn these," you know, and then I realized I took them off and I could see that they were prescription. I'm going, "No wonder I'm not, you know." And she laughed about that. Once I got, and she got me another pair of regular glasses, and once I got those on, I was rolling. But before that, you know, those were, the numbers were fuzzy and stuff, and I had missed, you know, two or three of the number that I needed to read, you know, and put it on the line. But then here it was, my son's glasses. And so, but going back to my partner there, Nancy was my partner on the line, and she knew that I was not getting that much sleep with, you know, the family that I had and getting them off to school, and then I was lucky to lay back down for an hour or two, so I was getting maybe at the most 4 or 5 hours sleep a night and sometimes less. So she would let me sleep for that half hour, and then she'd wake me up to make sure I was awake enough to get going again. And I remember there were nights when I got out of there that I had to literally roll that window down to get home, to drive, even just to DeWitt, to keep myself awake so I didn't fall asleep at the wheel. Back in those days, they didn't have child care providers, and I went through, on that shift, I don't know how many babysitters I went through. You know, I'd no more than get somebody in there with my kids and, you know, they'd be gone, or they'd find another job, or, you know, they're moving, or they had to do something else. So I went through all kinds of babysitters, and Nancy knew, you know, it was tough there for a while when I had really small kids. And, you know, she was right there to encourage me and be there to wake me up and, you know, get me a cup of coffee and stick it in my face so that I could get a little jump start there again to do the next 3 or 4 hours to get me out of there. So I'd have to, and she stood up with me when we got married too.
So, Marilyn Coulter.
Now, I am Marilyn Coulter. So speaking of when you got married, you met your husband here, yes?
Oh, yeah. I didn't meet him the second day, but I was put right next to him or his group of, what were they doing? Door rubbers. They were doing, there was like four of them. And my husband now was one of those door rubber people. And, you know, of course, at the time, he was just one of those. When I hired in, everybody was growing this real scruffy beard, and I'm going like, "Man, these men are scruffy looking," because they just had, you know, a couple of days of growth on their face, and I'm going like, "Ooh," you know. So he was in the process of growing his first beard, you know, but he was one of the individuals that came to my rescue that I told them about before, trying to install those trunk rubbers. And they even had bets going that I found out later on as the rumors go around the plant that are not always the most accurate, but bets that I would not be able to cut the job because I was looked like such a wuss when I hired in there coming right straight out of a doctor's office. You know, and you know, there was all kinds of rumors going about, they did have it accurate that I was divorced. They had some age they didn't have accurate, which was to my benefit. kids, I think they knew that I had some children. And the other rumor that went around was that I cheated on my husband and that's why I was divorced. I mean, all the typical things that get, you know, heated up and spread over the plant. And the betting, the one thing I got after him, I said, "You were one of those people that had bet that I wasn't going to make it on this line, and I was determined, I don't care whether I heard or not, I was going to make it. So,
how did that work for you, working in the building, the same place that your husband worked at, or future husband?
Oh, I mean, we didn't always work in the same areas. Like, I was in the cushion room, he was in trim. I went to paint for a while because of my seniority. He had 13 years ahead of me in seniority. So, actually, you know, we were best buddies. I mean, for years, even before we got married, we had lunch together. We played cards with the guys together, although he never wanted to be my partner because I made too many dumb euchre mistakes. But eventually, I could play euchre right along with the guys. Sodi was one of the guys. We'd always spend our lunch half hour playing cards, and I was usually the only gal there at the table, but I learned a lot in those days. Maybe not so much being a great euchre player, but those guys were very entertaining.
Okay. Sally, how would you say working in Fisher Body for Women was? Being a woman in Fisher Body, what was that like?
Well, I had a very awesome, responsible job. But I think, you know, it's still a man's world. It's still most of the decisions. Look at the shop committee. You've got all men. A lot of decisions are based on men's thoughts and values. And I still don't think there's equality as far as believing that we are as equal in intelligence or processes or being able to handle jobs. I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard other individuals make the statement, she's way in over her head, on top of their conclusion that we're more emotional, so therefore we do not handle ourselves as well as they do, and we are not as capable of doing things as they are. And, you know, I think they are not probably considered for some areas because of the gender, whereas they think, you know, it's just they think that men are more capable of doing things, and I think that's hogwash.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, well, see, number one, because as far as with our shop committee, those are elected positions by workforce, and even though it is a gender mix, it's still predominantly men working there, so that's why those men are the ones who get elected for those positions, because most of the voting public are the men work male workers.
Well, I think women are more intimidated to run against some of these individuals because they've got the experience. Well, they don't have the experience because it's been predominantly men. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of women would probably, if given, you know, more consideration, I think
the opportunity they could stand.
Right. You know, and I don't think those opportunities are levied out on an even playing field. I'm sorry, but that's what I've seen.
So with you feeling like that, and with some of the young people coming in now, because we still have some workers who are 10 years, 5 years, what would you like, what's the one thing you'd like to see those young female workers try to do now?
I would say, you know, don't sell yourself short. You know, go out there. You know you can handle a job. You know, even if you start small at an area that maybe not as notable or, you know, but start with something. Even, you know, getting into the union and getting on some of the committees. Now, that was one thing. I was never on a committee, but I think I had my hands full on other things most of the time. But, you know, start getting involved and, you know, even in your community, you know, that you are capable of doing big things. And, you know, those kind of things will get some attention when being considered for some of these union positions. But don't ever sell yourself short. But, and, you know, I think you have to promote yourself. You know, I don't think I promoted myself because I felt like the job that I did should be based on, you know, serving those people. But sometimes the political ramifications do not give you any push towards being on those equal playing fields. So you have to sometimes blow your own horn. And, you know, because people sometimes don't recognize some of the effort and some of the real frustration you had in doing, you know, what you had to do.
Sally, in working on the line during those 9 years, and you worked in the departments, I know you worked with Nancy, but on the average, how many women were on the line working with you in your groups?
Actually, there was quite a few women, I mean, that were brought in the same time I was, and that was back in the late 70s. So there was a lot more women in the plant then.
But in your specific area, your working area, like if you were in an area of 35 people, how many of those 35 were women that you could see that you could communicate with?
Oh, probably maybe a half dozen out of the area. Yeah. I never had any problems communicating with women. You know, and I didn't have that many problems communicating with men either.
Yeah, I know. But for some women, they've worked in areas and for maybe 6 or 8 people around them, they might have been the only female. Mm-hmm. And if that might have had something to do with the way women functioned in the plant, maybe they didn't feel that they could do the job or things like that.
Well, you know, there's power in numbers. So I think that's what you got to keep in mind. I mean, women can move mountains, and I see women in this union that are they are the silent caretakers back here that always set up all the different functions, and whether it's the Christmas function or the function you were a part of all these years. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the women that are doing a lot of the heavy duty work that are doing this. Now, I'm not sure that the women are always getting the recognition for that. Some cases they are, in some cases they aren't, but it's always the women in the union that I think have carried maybe a wee bit heavier load, but maybe not have gotten the recognition through the years.
Last thing, you talk about union activity. When you came in here, did you get any kind of union orientation or learn any history, like the women's auxiliary who did carry the union?
No, the only thing I remember that was mentioned about the union was signing the paper for union dues, and that they were going to take, you know, the monthly union dues out, which was 2 hours of your paycheck, and that, you know, that there were union meetings available, but they didn't really promote the union. But, you know, and so other than, you know, when you got on the line, people would tell you, well, if you have a problem, then you can call your committee man. No, there was no schooling.
Like they have now.
Like they have now. That, you know, the union's available for this resource and that resource. No, of course, there was no ergonomics back then.
So good things have happened, though.
Yeah, there have been lots of good things happening.
Doreen Howard, you were here during all the different name changes that the plant went through. What's your feelings of the different name changes, and what do you go by? What do you call the plant?
Fisher Body. And, you know, it's always going to be Fisher Body to me because I hired him when my dad worked at Fisher Body, and Now, I was working at Fisher Body. I wish I had all the money that they put into making all these name changes when somebody came up with this idea overnight that we were now going to become, you know, Lansing Car Assembly or... Mm-hmm. I mean, I couldn't even keep up with the name changes. Normally I just said Fisher Body, Plant 6, something. And they go, oh, yeah, well, Fisher Body, I know that. Mm-hmm. LCA, Body Plant. You know, people on the outside didn't, you know, keep up with the changes either, so.
This is Doreen Howard. Sally, is there anything that you wanted to talk about today that we haven't asked you about at all?
Well, I kind of touched on it, basically, but to let, it, I think it's a really big thing to let people know they're appreciated. You know, because a lot of times, you know, unless you tell them, you know, they don't know that. And it makes a big difference, whether it be a supervisor, a union official, a manager, to let people know that they're doing a good job and that you really appreciate their efforts. And if it takes 5 minutes to just pull them aside and let them know that, you know, a cup of coffee doesn't hurt, or, you know, because most people have put in a lot more than anybody ever would ever realize out there. And I think that would make a world of difference in people's attitude out there in any position, whether they're a line worker or one of these appointed people or, you know,
a manager.
Exactly. The managers don't, I mean, other than their reviews, and just to let them know that during that course of time that they're doing a good job. You know, I think people are people. They pull their pants on the same. They have hearts. They have souls. And, you know, that keeping that spirit and keeping things up is what's going to keep this company in business.
All right.
So.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, well, thank you for your interview.